The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Glory America, bonjour, hi, Kennedy, Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. I must tell you, last night I was talking with a former national figure, a senior advisor to President Trump, a longtime fixture in Republican Party circles, who for 20 years has waged a good fight in Afghanistan, and as the American dream for that country dies, and there's no other way to put it. I'm going to talk with Representative Liz Cheney about it later today. On top of the collapse of the commitment to free enterprise represented by the Democratic Party's full embrace of socialism and the passage of a full-on socialist budget by Bernie Sanders in the Senate after already $4 trillion of spending over 2 years. It will mean $8 trillion of printed money. After all of that, I was feeling pretty low last night, saying, my gosh, what have we done for 20 years? What have we been fighting for 40 years? If we're just going to be a socialist backwaters country that can't keep our commitments to people we fight for, we pull it. Because I began my life with the fall of southern Vietnam, helicopters on the embassy in Saigon. I went to college. I was a sophomore in college when that happened, 1975. And here we are. Kabul will look that way within 30 days. They're saying 90 days now. I'm not giving them 90 days. Unless the Taliban decide, well, we don't need it. We'll take it next fighting season. Let's just go live in Kandahar and Kunduz for the rest of the year, and we'll get Kabul next year. Then it might not fall, but otherwise, we're gone. We're just getting our people out, and God bless our Marines for doing that. But then I thought, fight on, my men, said Sir Andrew Barton. I am hurt, but I am not slain. I'll lay me down and bleed a while and rise and fight again. It's my motto. After you get wiped out, 2008, you get wiped out in 2006, you get wiped out at the polls in 2018, you just realize there's a 1994 out there somewhere. There's a 1980 out there somewhere. Indeed, I think we're going to wipe out the Democrats. This country does not want to be a socialist country. And the Democrats are socialists. All of them. They all voted for it. Now it's going to go to the House. It's a pure transfer of wealth. It's taking the money you earned. They're going to tax at death everything you've got. They're going to not raise the basis. Your houses, your farms, your businesses are going to take them away from your kids and tax them, make them sell them. Take 45 to 55% of that and put it into their plans to pay their buddies off in the teachers' unions. And they're going to mask your kids, and they're going to ignore your demands of critical race theory, be booted out. And you know what? Time to rise and fight again. Here's the deal. The first round in the comeback is Glenn Youngkin in Virginia. So I want you to go to YoungkinForGovernor.com and send him money. YoungkinForGovernor.com. He's taking on old Clintonite Terry McAuliffe, a corrupt, absolutely old school, take as much money as you can, tax as many people as you can, spend it on your friends, Democrat. He's in there with the new socialists. Ralph Northam, a racist, is the governor who didn't resign like Andrew Cuomo resigned, just corrupt. McAuliffe is corrupt. Glenn Youngkin is just Mitt Romney with a common touch, born because he came out of nowhere with nothing, and played his way to a basketball scholarship, and then lived in Richmond and Virginia Beach, and then came and went to work for a great venture capital firm in D.C., did it all, made his own money, built his own businesses, made a lot of money, got four wonderful kids, a wonderful wife, attends McLean Bible Church. He's a normal guy, he's a normal Christian guy, and he's smart. And everybody in Virginia, we got to stop this nonsense. It begins in the Commonwealth. And you in America can support Glenn Youngkin. But if you're in Virginia, go get a Glenn Youngkin yard sign. I got to go get one and then upset my condo association or homeowners association, put it on my little yard, and drive the little bitty around here who's the police department for where I live. She's going to come and complain about my Yunkin sign. I'm going to get 10 of them so I can put them up 10 days in a row. Because I'm not giving up freedom. And the Democrats in Congress are counting on you giving up freedom, your money, and your kids. Don't do it. Then, at the same time, you go find out which congressman you have right now and you begin to call them. Tell them to vote against this budget. Do not vote for this budget. You are not a socialist. This is not a socialist country. You do not vote for tax hikes. You are watching them, Republican and Democrat. You give them a little backbone and you tell them, I have got eyes on you. I don't know who your congressperson is. Might be a Republican, might be a Democrat. You start calling. You call that district office. And then you go to any meeting that they organize in their district. Time for the Tea Party to come back times 10. Now, some of them died between now and the Tea Party. But I go way back to the Sagebrush Revolution in 1978, Prop 13 in 1978. You call your congressman you get involved in California. You go get your ballot and you vote yes. Throw Gavin Newsom out on his ass. Toss him out. Gavin Newsom imploded yesterday, by the way. Let's listen to Gavin Newsom melting down because he sees the numbers. Larry Elder's got him spooked. Cut number 20.
I think the consequences of having the second incumbent governor in California recalled of the last three, to see the weaponization of the recall process be as effective as a successful recall effort here, would weaponize the recall process even more than it currently is with DAs and city council members and school boards. I think the opportunity for the Republican Party with the midterm elections coming up in Kevin McCarthy's backyard, in Nancy Pelosi's state, in Kamala Harris's home state, with California and the values we profess and practice, that would be judged in a different light if this was a successful recall, I think it would have profound consequences nationwide and go to not just politics, but to policy and policy making. It would go deep to issues of immigration, climate policy, healthcare, broadly defined situationally, COVID, but even beyond that, I think its repercussions would be felt next year in a governor's race for election and beyond.
So we could, you know, maybe take the French Laundry fiasco out of the mix. You feel like your actions and decisions of governor would rise to a level where a recall is a fair response from the voters?
No, not at all. We also are doing something that the former occupant of this building is very much responsible for, the initiation, not to exaggerate, because he wasn't exclusively responsible, but in that budget in 1967, where Ronald Reagan inherited a major deficit, he very infamously had his finance department make massive mental health cuts, which he later denied much knowledge of, curious as that may sound. That began the process of this devolvement to the cities and counties that never manifested of our mental health system. I'm very concerned about the fact that you had as many people get an FBI background check, 39.7 million people, as there are Californians last year in the U.S. I'm very concerned about guns in this state. I'm concerned about these radical judges, no other way to describe, stone-cold radical judges that are trying to overrule our gun safety laws, particularly as it relates to weapons of war and that assault weapons ban. It's not just about the law. It's about the culture and the attitudes and the permissiveness that sends, the message that sends. I am not one of those people that think you can smash someone's window or knock over some grandma and somehow have a slap on the wrist. I don't buy that. At the same time, I'll take a backseat to nobody in my desire to deal with the hell. What the hell's wrong with you that you did that in the first place? And try to get under the hood and try to address that issue in a compassionate, thoughtful, and judicious way. But I believe in accountability as well. And so I'm not throwing up my hands, and I don't think most folks in the reform movement are either. And I totally reject that people can't do anything about retail theft. I mean, I didn't go to law school. I wasn't smart enough to go to law school. I couldn't pass the LSAT, but I can read the penal code sections and, forgive me, look them up. 666. Google it right now.
Look, he falls apart. He's falling apart under the pressure. So here's what you do. Get a Glenn Youngkin sign, contribute to Youngkin for governor. Go to Larry Elder's campaign site, contribute to Larry Elder. If you're Kevin Faulkner, fine, whoever you are in California, vote to recall Gavin Newsom and then lean on your congressman. We're going to talk fighting back against the Democrat socialist takeover of the United States. Bernie Sanders is not my boss. He's not your boss. Fight back. We'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt, joined by Michael Oren, the former ambassador to the United States, the former ambassador from Israel to the United States. Dr. Michael Oren is back in Israel. Good morning, Dr. Oren. How are you?
And welcome back to you too, Hugh.
I know. I'm glad to be back. I have a very simple but complex question. I read the Times of Israel to actually find out what's going on with the virus because Israel's ahead of everybody else. They've got a booster strategy ready. They know what's up. They know what's down. They have credible people who speak with authority into the public. Why does Israel have a functioning public health directorate, authority, respected, and the United States has a complete collapse of credibility with everyone?
Well, one of the reasons is it has to do with the founding fathers. You can blame Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay, because the founding fathers of the United States were so frightened of central authority, so frightened of the tyranny of the English king, that they made authority very diffuse. So, you know, the governor of New York can't tell the mayor of New York to close the schools of New York. But we have one authority here, which tells the entire state what to do, and everyone's going to do it. So, we didn't have the founding fathers, but and they did some wonderful things. But on the question of dealing with a national emergency, health emergency, I guess they didn't foresee that possibility. I got my third vaccination this week.
You just pissed me off. I was just inveighing against the CDC because everybody knows people need boosters. Everybody. And they announced yesterday they will have a booster strategy in September, and they don't even know what they're going to recommend. And Israel has already got Michael Oren, who's my age, getting his third booster. Unfreaking believable.
Yep.
Can I make Aliyah? My wife is one quarter Jewish. Can I make Aliyah?
Yes, you can. If not, we'll make it happen.
But, okay, because honest to God, she's one quarter Jewish. I can prove it. Really, I can get there.
You're in. We'll get you in here. But even then, we're talking about now limiting the number of people in restaurants, limiting the number of people in stores. Masks are mandatory.
And do you put masks on your kids?
Building. I can't walk into my own building without a mask.
How about K through 3? Do you mask your children?
Yes, they have to go with FE masks.
That's stupid.
They do, and soon they'll be. The question is whether they're going to be encapsulated, where they put kids, you know, like three kids in each section of a class.
No, pods make sense. Ventilation makes sense. Pod, but kindergartners through third grade, masks do not work. There's not a scintilla of evidence for that.
Well, they do it, and we're trying to contain it. The numbers are still going up. The numbers are still going up.
You know, you got a booster.
I got a booster.
Are you Pfizer, Moderna, J&J? Pfizer?
No, we got Pfizer's. These are Pfizer's.
No, I turned to the Times of Israel to find out that Pfizer is less effective than Moderna. They stop hospitalization and death, so that's fine. I'm Pfizer. But I want my third Pfizer shot now.
Well, you have to come over. You have to get your third shot.
Now tell me one more thing. How is the new government doing in terms of the health crisis? Is it seamless from the Netanyahu government today? Does everyone believe that's not part of the political debate?
You know, it's like the Book of Jonah. Okay, do you remember the Book of Jonah?
Yes,
it's like the shortest book in the Bible. It's all the page long. God tells Jonah to go to Nineveh.
He says no.
Nineveh, you don't repent, I'm going to destroy you. And then Jonah runs away because he realizes he's in a no-win situation. If he tells the people of Nineveh to repent and they repent, they're going to come back to him 2 years later and say, why did we have to repent? Nothing happened, right? But if they don't repent and they're destroyed, then Jonah's a failed prophet. So either way, he loses. That's pretty much what it's like being the prime minister of Israel.
That's why I didn't want to go. But yeah.
You get locked down and there's lockdown, and then nothing happens. People are going to go back to them and say, hey, why did we have to lock down? Why do we have to pay that price? But if we don't lock down and we are overwhelmed by a pandemic, people say, you know, Tali Bennett, you failed us as a prime minister.
Is it because people are unvaccinated, or is it because of breakout infection?
It's because people are vaccinated. First, like, for example, almost a half of the Arab population is unvaccinated. And we have people who, you know, are against vaccinations. The people in the religious community are against vaccinations. So we have that problem. But we're seeing people who have two, and in some cases even three vaccinations, still getting corona.
So okay, what do you think defines the unvaccinated population in Israel? What demographic, not what factor would you say is the likeliest indicator of vaccination? I have a theory in the United States, but what do you think?
No, it's not ideological here. It's traditional. It's people living in small villages who, it's not that they don't have access to health care, but they're maybe distrustful of that system. And that's why Israel's working through the tribal heads, the Arab tribal heads, saying, you know, go take all your people. Tell us.
If we lined up the unvaccinated.
Do it to the rabbis, too.
If we lined up the unvaccinated and we did years of secular education, would that be the answer?
I think that people who are secular, people who are modern, people who are urban, have a much, much higher level of vaccination.
And are educated?
And educated, sure.
It's because I think the correlation in the United States is people who've spent at least 12 years in school, and the 16-year the college graduates are like 100% educated, vaccinated. It correlates with the scientific method.
Yeah, you have a couple of people who are ideological, you know, but I don't know many.
I don't know many either. I don't know what's wrong with people. They're gambling with death. Michael Oren, I'm Aliyah. Look it up. Find out if I can get in. Betsy's a quarter Jewish. That's all I got for you. Half Jewish. Quarter Jewish. I can't remember. Genetic. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt back inside the Beltway. And 4 days back in the Beltway, and allergies have seized my vocal cords. So I sound like I've been hit in the throat. Just excuse that. Headline today from the Washington Post. Hundreds of Afghan forces surrounded the Taliban in northern Afghanistan on Wednesday. The military's most significant collapse since the withdrawal of U.S. forces. After holding out for days at a military base on the edge of Kunduz, an entire Afghan army corps surrendered to Taliban fighters Wednesday morning. I'm joined by Representative Liz Cheney of the House Armed Services Committee because she and I have shared a point of view on Afghanistan for 20 years. And this is a dark and grim week. Congressman Cheney, welcome back. What do you think is happening?
Hi, Hugh. Well, thank you for having me back. And you're exactly right. And what's happening is not a surprise. It's what was clear would happen. It is, in many ways, catastrophic. The United States had approximately 2,500 forces in Afghanistan conducting counterterrorism, counterinsurgency mission, working very closely with the Afghans to help to ensure the Taliban was not able to establish this kind of control of territory to ensure the Taliban and their close allies, continued allies, fighting partners, Al-Qaeda, did not get themselves into a position where they could have free rein and set up safe havens again for terrorist training camps of the kind we saw prior to 9/11. President Biden made the decision to withdraw all of our forces, and what we're seeing now is the consequence of that, and it really is devastating.
Liz Cheney, I was probably the most vocal proponent of President Bush and Vice President Cheney's policy, and I believe we should have treated Afghanistan like South Korea, that we should have been there as long as it took because proximity to Iran and China and Russia, the critical necessity of keeping terrorists out, and yet it seems like they're not fighting for themselves. These are not battles. These are just surrenders. They're not in the trenches. They're not dying to the last man. It doesn't seem like they are willing after 20 years to sacrifice anything except American lives and treasure.
Well, I think you've got to recognize the circumstances that the Afghan forces are facing now. For example, they have been able to rely on U.S. air power. Being able to fight the Taliban when you can count on our air power is a whole different thing than the situation we're in today. You know, the military and the administration kept saying, and frankly, the Trump administration was saying the same thing because President Trump wanted to do this. President Biden did do it. It was wrong then and it's wrong now. but kept saying, we'll have forces stationed over the horizon. We can provide help if it's needed. You know, well, over the horizon turns out to be, what, 7-8 hours away. So being in a situation where America has abandoned our allies in Afghanistan, NATO is following suit, we've basically left the Afghans to the control of the Taliban. You know, and it is a brutal, horrific terrorist organization. And we're seeing what's happening now. They're moving in, and obviously what they're doing to the women is just disgraceful. They're trying to hollow out civil society. They're killing tribal elders. They're shutting down radio stations. They're conducting targeted killings of people involved in media and culture, people who are working to stop this kind of radical Islamic emirate from being established. But it is at the end of the day going to demonstrate to be very bad for U.S. national security interests and certainly for our allies and for the people of Afghanistan, I'm afraid.
Now, Congresswoman Cheney, for 17 years, I've held two fundraisers a year for the Semper Fi Fund because 2,312 U.S. military personnel died in Afghanistan. 20,066 have been seriously wounded and continue to require, and we should continue to provide care for them. Did they fight in vain after 20 years? Was it all for naught?
No, absolutely not. The fact that for 20 years we were able to prevent terrorist safe havens from being established, we were able to help to work with the Afghan government. You know, they kept us safe for all of these years from, you know, further terrorist attacks from the soil of Afghanistan. So certainly not in vain. However, I do think that the decision that President Biden's made, this withdrawal, isn't worthy of the sacrifices that they've made. And, you know, when you look just at how the State Department, for example, is handling this, I mean, it's an embarrassment, and it has a huge impact on America's standing around the world. The State Department is setting up, you know, hashtags and saying the Taliban has an interest in coming to the table. Let's negotiate. The Taliban isn't going to do anything like that. The Taliban now has got the momentum to conduct this massive military offensive. I think last I saw they control at this point something like 2/3 of the territory. And for the American State Department, you know, a superpower, the leader of the world, to be, you know, have our spokesman up there talking about hashtags, it makes us a laughingstock. So we really do have to get back to a place where our allies can count on us, where they know we're going to stand with them, we're not going to abandon them, and we're going to conduct our foreign policy in a way that's worthy of the men and women in uniform who sacrificed so much for all of us.
You know, I actually believe that Secretary Blinken going on the radio was a disaster because they had grudging respect for Mike Pompeo. They had great respect for President Bush, some grudging respect for Hillary Clinton. They were afraid of wave after wave of B-52 bombers or something worse when we were in Bagram. I thought we could have just withdrawn to Bagram and held them at bay, but now we're gone. And the question becomes, what do we do with the American military? And the budget that the Democrats passed on the Senate two nights ago leaves me completely dispirited. We will have spent $7 trillion by the end of this year, and I don't think 1% of that is going to America's defense, Congresswoman.
Yeah, look, I mean, this budget and the reckless spending on everything basically but defense is really horrifying. And, you know, you have a situation where the United States government has one single most important obligation above everything else, and that's to defend the nation. We have seen year after year military leaders, the civilian leaders of the Pentagon, both parties tell us what is necessary, and that is at a minimum 3-5% real growth annually in that budget. And that was what was necessary in order to carry out the national defense strategy of 3 or 4 years ago. So our adversaries in the meantime have made huge advances, and we are not right now conducting ourselves in a way, making the investments we need to maintain military supremacy. And without that, we lose our ability to deter our adversaries. We lose our ability to be able to build the kind of alliances we need to stand against the China threat, the Russia threat, Iran, North Korea. People, they just will walk away and say, well, you can't count on the Americans anymore. And that will lead to a very dangerous world and one that we certainly don't want to have to live in.
Your counterpart across, Congresswoman Luria, is a rational Democrat. She's from Virginia Beach. Now, the Hewitts are a Navy family. Virginia Beach needs a serious budget. We need shipyards to be civilian shipyards to be invested in real infrastructure. How does she expect to get reelected when they don't even spend in the infrastructure bill money on civilian shipyards and public shipyards when they don't do anything? Does she really expect Virginia Beach to reelect her?
Well, look, I think that that is a question. Certainly, it's a question that we've got to deal with across the country. Virginia Beach is a great example. But, you know, we need to look at our military industrial base and look at the kinds of investments that are necessary across the board. So I think that you will see the Armed Services Committee tends to be one of the least partisan committees. And, you know, but this year we're going to have some very major and significant debates and policy battles over just this issue.
But these Democrats can't have it both ways, can they?
Right.
They can't say
right.
I'm an armed services hawk and then vote for the Bernie Sanders budget. Right. You can't have it both ways.
You can't. That's exactly right. You know, if you want to really do what's necessary to defend the nation, you have to support the investments. And that means you've got to support a budget that provides the kind of growth that's necessary. You have to support a top line that provides the kind of growth that's necessary. I mean, there's you know, reality and there's rhetoric. And when it comes to the defense of the nation, it has severe consequences if you engage in the political rhetoric, but you don't back it up with the support for the kind of budget numbers we need.
Last question. Are you optimistic about defeating the Bernie Sanders? But they've only got five votes. They can barely lose two congressmen. Are there enough sane Democrats? It's like Abraham arguing with the angel not to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. If I can find five, don't destroy the Congress. Do you think you can find five?
Boy, I sure hope so, Hugh. I mean, I think this budget puts them in such a difficult position. I think you see that in terms of what's happening inside their caucus. The fact that the moderate Democrats who are facing tough reelection fights don't want to have to take this vote. They want to be able to vote on infrastructure. And there's a reason for that, because this is just an unbelievable set of wasteful spending. So I'm hopeful we will be able to have at least five sane folks on the other side on this budget issue.
Good luck. You're playing Abraham to the Democratic Congress. I hope you get there. Liz Cheney, great to have you back, Representative. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
To get my Cleveland heart.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. I've got a Cleveland heart. So does my next guest, Jane Timken, running for Senate in Ohio. Jane Timken was the chair of the Ohio Republican Party. She's an Akron lady. She is a great friend of the program, and she will be in one of the candidates that I interview at the debate in Columbus in October. Hello, Jane Timken. Welcome back.
Thanks, Hugh. Thanks for having me.
Have you heard Jackson Brown's new song, Cleveland Heart, yet?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's about getting a heart transplant at the Cleveland Clinic, I think. But it's a terrific, terrific song, so I recommend it to you. Tell me, Jane, how goes the campaign?
It's going great. You know, Hugh, I'm not the kind of person who can sit on the sidelines. I stepped up and ran against John Kasich's handpicked chair when the Ohio Republican Party pulled away from Donald Trump. And I turned the Ohio Republican Party into a well-oiled machine that delivered Republican victories up and down the ballot. And look, I can't sit on the sidelines anymore with what's happening in our country. We have rising inflation, our border crisis, huge amounts of socialist spending coming out of Washington. I'm crisscrossing the state of Ohio, and my campaign message is resonating, and we're doing very well. As you know, I love Ohio, and I'm going to be in the fight for Ohio in the United States Senate.
Now, we've got at least four good candidates. There's Josh Mandel, who will be on later, J.D. Vance. We've got maybe State Senator Dolan of the Dolans who own the Indians family, a car dealer whose name I cannot remember, and you. And I always say when there's one woman and five candidates, always look for the last man standing to be a woman. Just because a lot of people vote that way. I haven't seen any polling. I'm staying away from endorsements until after the debate. What do the numbers look like, Jane Timken?
Oh, they look very good for me. Since I announced in February, I've quadrupled our position. My message is resonating with Ohioans. They know that I've been in the trenches fighting for the America First agenda. When I was chair of the party, I put 150,000 miles in two cars crisscrossing the state. Look, I, as chair, I know how to win Ohio. You have to be on the ground. You have to be talking to voters. We are the only campaign that is running a ground game, that is actually out talking to voters, knocking doors and making phone calls. And we've surpassed 300,000 voter contacts. But look, it's about showing up and delivering a message that resonates. And Ohioans are gravitating towards me because they know I'm a fighter. They know I've been in this fight. They know that I'm strong to push back against the Democrats and their socialist agenda. They want to fundamentally transform this country. I'm going to be standing up for our freedoms and for our good jobs and our economy here in Ohio.
Jane Timken, I got to go hyper local for a second. Do you know Loveland, Ohio?
Sure do.
Okay. My law school roommate, one of the best men I know, Tim Butler's on the city council there. He's a Republican. He's a Trump Republican. He's against building a parking garage there. He's against developers giving money to candidates, et cetera. He's hardcore, and the Republican Party is purging him. He's up for re-election, and you must have dealt with this in parties all over the state. Do you know Tim Butler? Do you know Loveland Republican Party? What is wrong with those people?
I think I know Tim, and look, you know, I always say the way to win as Republicans, we need to be united. And I think I've done a really good job as being a unifying chairman. I'm going to be a unifying candidate. We need to bring everybody into the fold to fight back against the Democrats. That's how we win. We can't have this infighting. We need to be out there fighting the Democrats because what's at stake is our country. Quite frankly, I believe Barack Obama and Bernie Sanders, they want to fundamentally transform our country. And what you're seeing out of Washington is a push towards socialism and government control. And that is not American. And I will always be standing up to fight back against it. You see it happening in our schools. You see it happening with the socialist spending that's coming out of Washington. We need someone in the United States Senate that's going to fight for this. And we need to take back the Senate and the House and push back against this. And that's why I'm in this fight.
Now, Jane Timken, I'm very, very pro-vaccine and have been forever. But I'm very anti-masking K-3 because there's no scientific evidence it works. And there's a lot of scientific evidence that it hurts children in the primary grades. What's your position on masking very young children in school?
Look, I'm against it. I'm against mask mandates. That it is a decision that a parent should make for a child. It's not a decision that politicians or government officials should make for children. There's no real study that says that masking in these schools is going to prevent the spread of COVID.
Yes, that's right.
And this is more about government control, and the damaging effects that have happened to our children are quite frankly frightening. They've had a year of virtual learning where God knows what was happening, but they also are not able to fully socialize and adapt in school. And again, what's happened this year of the pandemic, parents have woken up and realized what's the indoctrination of their children. I started a listening tour on critical race theory. It is really happening in our schools. It is invasive, and it is in the indoctrination of our children to hate America and to put children in boxes based on the color of their skin. It's un-American, and it's against the teachings of Martin Luther King, which is we are to judge each other on the content of our character, not the color of our skin. And I think it's very oppressive to put kids in these boxes and tell them they will never succeed.
Jane Timken, let me interject here. The left wing in the United States is attempting to deny that CRT is an issue. In fact, PolitiFact yesterday claimed that Glenn Youngkin, who's going to be the next governor of Virginia, is lying about critical race theory. And they came up with some harebrained scheme to say that it's not there. Everybody knows that CRT has infected every curriculum, every teacher. They don't have to wear a CRT button to be a part of it. It's everywhere. But do you run into the media denying the reality of CRT?
Yes, sure. But look, I have real people and real facts in real schools, and it is all across Ohio. In fact, this really started when I was having a business roundtable with women business leaders, and one mom in Canfield, Ohio, came up to me and said, do you know what's happening in our schools? This was a few months ago. And she said her kindergartner was being taught how to protest. They were being forced to draw themselves as different races. It was all about this CRT equity. And look, our kids are falling further and further behind. We are not educating our children for the jobs of the future. And it is, education is the key to the American dream, and we need to make sure we're educating our children and not indoctrinating them. It's real. It's happening. And I'm really, proud of the parents who are standing up and pushing back. I'm in this fight with them because it's about the American future for our children.
Now, Jane, I'm a big supporter of Catholic schools because I came out of Kennedy High School in Warren. But I also believe in homeschooling. And in fact, I brought on a new sponsor this week called PowerHomeschool.org, which is non-ideological. It's just that parents are done with public schools in a lot of places. Will you support charter schools and homeschooling from the United States Senate if you win?
Yes. In fact, there is a backpack bill that's pending here in Ohio. I'm supportive of that. The funds should follow the child. I'm the product of a Catholic school education as well. I think it gave me a wonderful foundation. Children should have that opportunity to get the best education they can, and it should not be dictated by their zip code or their failing school. I am a huge proponent of school choice and homeschooling because parents should be able to make the best decisions for their child. Education. Education is the key to a bright future, and I will always stand up for children to get the best education they can and fight for those resources to be there for those parents to make that choice.
Boy, I hope you didn't go to Steubenville Central Catholic or Akron St. Vincent St. Mary's. They used to crush Kennedy all the time. Where'd you go?
Oh, well, I actually grew up in Cincinnati, so I went to Annunciation and down in
Cincinnati.
Okay,
I'm a neutral in the Cincinnati Wars. Did they date Mueller boys?
I dated a St. X guy. So
okay, you're a Xavier person. Okay, we get that. So, Jane Timken, we're doing this debate, and I'm going to do a lot of prep like I did for the California recall debate. I know how to moderate a debate fairly. What do you think are the biggest issues defining the Republican would-be senator nominees?
Well, I guess, Hugh, I'll tell you, as I travel around Ohio, the big issues I hear about, I go to businesses big and small. Every day I hear about businesses that can't find enough people to get back to work. It's affecting our manufacturing plants. It's affecting our restaurants and small mom and pop businesses. Inflation is a huge issue. Everyone is complaining about the gas pump prices and their groceries. These are issues that are, quite frankly, on top of mind of Ohioans. And they are also concerned about the border. People have said to me, why does Ohio care about the border? It's because the drugs and human trafficking that are coming across the border are landing right here in Ohio. Ohio had a record overdose deaths last year, and it's because of the drugs and the fentanyl and the meth that are coming across the border. So those are the top issues for me as I travel around Ohio. Look, I'm looking forward to the debate. I think it's going to be a great event for people to showcase their thoughts. And as Hugh, I will tell you, I'm that happy warrior. I'll be in this fight, and I'm looking forward to being the next United States Senator from Ohio.
Jane Timken, what's the website?
JaneTimkenForOhio.com.
That's pretty easy. JaneTimkenForOhio.com. I will see you in October. Jane Timken, thank you for joining me again. Go Bucks.
Thanks, Hugh.
I always got to say go Bucks. I'm never sure. I'm reading Kirk Herbstreit's autobiography right now, and it's really terrific. He's such an Ohioan. He's such a Buckeye. It's really terrific. That Tim Butler story is going to be a national story. My law school roommate, Tim Butler, is one of the best men I know. I mean, really one of the best men I know. And I've known him for, 1980 to the present. That would be 41 years. And Tim just ran for city council in Little Loveland, Ohio, because he was just going to do his part. He's spent his life to raise his five kids. He's a grandpa. He's like me. He's probably 62. Given back, great city councilman. And he ran on a ticket of Republicans, and the Republicans got bought out. They got bought out by local developers. They got bought out by the vision of big white elephant parking lots, so they're throwing him out of the party. He's old school. Old school Republican, freedom and fiscal restraint. And so they're throwing him out of the party. T Tim Butler for council in Loveland and throw everyone, all the other incumbents out, toss them out. You know, they're not Republicans. I am tired of Republicans going on to local boards and becoming Democrats. I never did that. I served 17 years on the Children and Family Commission. We gave away $40 million a year, and I never became a Democrat. I believed in building things and giving money to groups that did it. We had the smallest staff. We paid ourselves nothing, which is very different. We gave ourselves no retirement benefit. We might have been the only agency in California that you could serve 17 years on and not get a pension. I think that actually was the Orange County Children and Families Commission because I helped set it up that way. No money for public service, no pension for public service. Had it with these people. ReliefFactor.com, America, ReliefFactor.com. I take it every day. I took it in the first hour. My voice is finally starting to warm up. I don't know what happened overnight. I think I was yelling at the TV last night too much when I saw Afghanistan falling apart. And then I watched Ted Lasso and realized Ted Lasso's woke. Honestly, I'm the Ted Lasso of talk radio, but I don't think I can say that anymore. I'm not woke. I don't use the F-bomb. Coach Beard, they've all gone south on me. I don't know what happened in the writer's room. But take my Relief Factor an hour ago, and all of a sudden my voice was getting better. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, 51 minutes after the hour. The United States Senate turned itself over to Bernie Sanders and went full-on socialist this week. Jim Talent joins me, senior fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Follow him on Twitter at Jim Talent, former member of the United States Senate. Jim, did you ever think you'd see the day that the Democratic Party became socialist?
Well, I said earlier in the year, Hugh, that they were going to borrow and spend an enormous amount of money. And that's what they're doing. They're burning the remaining credit of the United States and not even on the basic, even the social safety needs of the country. So nothing's going to be done here to fix a shortfall in Social Security, to make Medicare more secure for an aging population, to address the student loan debt and the bubble in the economy from that, health care for the poor. Nothing there. It's a grab bag of programs most Americans won't even be able to identify. And it's going to drive up, it's driving up inflation. I mean, I have
Senator Talent, I think it's a very crafty strategy. It's the reverse of the Reagan strategy. Expand the entitlement culture to the point that it bankrupts the United States and we have to withdraw from the world.
Well, I guess I think that's going to be the effect of it. I don't know that there's that much long-term thinking in this going on, you. But I mean, look, the interest on the federal debt last year was about, I think, about $380 billion with treasuries at 2%, right? So what happens when the Fed jacks up interest rates, as they will, in order to fight inflation? So if it goes to 4%, it's going to cost us another $400 billion to service the debt. And the entire discretionary budget is about, what, $1.7 trillion? So that's more than a quarter of the entire discretionary budget.
Yeah, I had a senior Trump administration official tell me last night, the only way out will be to devalue the currency. You get to do that once, and you're no longer the reserve currency.
They're going to debase. Well, it is debasing the currency. And Americans, of course, are going to they're feeling it right now. So you're going to get, maybe it depends on how it actually works out, they're going to pay for some pre-K programs for people, and you're going to be paying and aren't paying now already a lot more. I mean, you got to laugh or cry, as an old friend of mine says all the time. And I, you know, that this is, I think, to show that they can do something big and beat the Republicans. I mean, I don't want to be uncharitable. And yeah, there's a lot of bad policies. You've talked about the death tax, and you're right. They're eliminating work for all these welfare programs. So we're going to be treated to millions and millions of able-bodied people getting all this, you know, these benefits and not working because it doesn't make any sense for them to work.
It's economically rational to stay home, especially when they extended the rent moratorium. They screwed small landlords everywhere in the United States, but they also increased the incentive not to go back to work. You don't have a rent bill to pay.
Yeah, you know, if I just suspend thinking about the impact on the country, it's going to be fun to watch to see them try and get the votes for the tax increases. Remember, I said they're going to borrow and spend a lot of money. Now, you know, when the tax increases come up, we're going to see how that plays. Okay.
Well, Liz Cheney today said she hopes that they can find five Democrats. Do you think they can find five Democrats in the House to oppose this?
I think of the taxing pieces, yes. They're not going to raise taxes. This is $3.5 trillion they say they want to spend over 10. That's $350 billion a year in tax increases. There's no way in the world they find votes for that. So, again, it's the net effect of this is going to be to borrow and spend enormous amounts of money, force inflation up without addressing even the safety net needs. Forget about defense, which they're not spending any money on either, right?
Right.
And then it's ushering in its chaos, a sort of left-wing flavored chaos. And I think it's because they don't have the votes and they don't really have the plan to do anything else. So, if I think about it too much,
Now, you know Joe Biden and you know Bernie Sanders. Is Joe Biden in charge of this or has Bernie Sanders just been deferred to?
Yeah, I think this is sort of policy by default. What is it we can do that we can tell the activist base they should like? I don't think at the end of the day they're going to be satisfied either. And then we'll do that. I kind of think that's what's happening. Because I don't see any other logic behind it. I mean, again, there are basic needs that need to be addressed in the social safety net system. Now, you're not going to address it by creating a whole raft of other little programs on much lower priority items, but there's a whole lot of things that need to be done. And then I look at the tax increases. You're right about the death tax. That's going to slam. I chaired the Small Business Committee for 4 years. All it does is make small businesses and farms impossible to pass on the next generation. The last
and houses.
How much money we raised from the death tax? You $20 billion a year.
Wow. It's just not worth the candle to destroy the American dream for so many people. Jim Talent, always a pleasure, Senator. Follow him at Jim Talent. He is really one of the sanest people in D.C. I'll be right back. Josh Mandel, like Jane Timken, wants to go to the Senate. He joins me next on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt back inside the Beltway. Joined by Josh Mandel, former treasurer of Ohio, now a candidate to replace the retiring Rob Portman. Good morning, Josh. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. I got to tell you where I was last night.
Tell me.
We did a town hall meeting in Cortland, Ohio.
Oh, beautiful town. Cortland. My nephew lives there.
Yeah, so we were at a top-notch diner. There was this patriot. Her name is Shauna, and she's the owner of the restaurant, and we packed it in. I mean, it was standing room only, and as you know, that's the heart of it all there, right there in the Mahoning Valley.
You are in the Steel Valley in the heart of the land. Josh Mandel, I believe you served in Afghanistan. You might have served in Iraq and not Afghanistan. Did you serve in Afghanistan?
I did two tours in Iraq, never made it to Afghanistan.
Okay, so you're still in the war. What do you think about the collapse underway now?
It's tough to watch. I mean, it's very tough to watch. I believe in a lot of ways that America fell into the same trap that a lot of countries have over many decades and even centuries in Afghanistan. And, you know, one of the things that's underestimated there is the difficulty of the land and the locals' familiarity with the land. I mean, it is treacherous there. Extremely mountainous, and it's why very powerful forces from very powerful countries over the years have struggled there, and it's just tough to watch.
Do you think that the Biden administration will bug out of Iraq like they've bugged out of Afghanistan?
I assume so. Yeah, I assume so. I mean, there's nothing foreign policy-wise about Joe Biden that I have confidence in. You know, one of the things that worries me the most about Biden, I won't even say the Biden doctrine because I don't even know what the Biden doctrine is, but what worries me about Biden is them once again playing footsie with Iran. As we all know, you know, in the middle of the night, Obama dropped a pallet of hundreds of billions of American tax money to Iran. And make no mistake about it, the Islamic Republic of Iran is run by terrorists. It's terrorists who fund Hezbollah. It's terrorists who export their industry of terrorism throughout the Middle East and throughout the globe. And you know, what's difficult to watch with the Biden foreign policy is watching them once again enable the regime in Iran. You know, what needs to happen in Iran is we should be enabling the people to topple the regime, not enabling the regime to export terrorism. But you know,
I believe it was $1.3 billion in small bills and hard currency and hundreds of billions of dollars in sanctions relief. But I also think yesterday the new hardcore killer prime minister announced a cabinet that includes as their interior minister the man wanted in the Buenos Aires bombing. It's really incredible that we're even talking to these terrorists.
It's unbelievable, Hugh. It is unbelievable. But listen, one of the things that President Trump understood is the acknowledgement of who are our friends and who are our enemies and treating them as such. And that doesn't mean starting wars. It doesn't mean military adventurism. But it means being realistic about who's in the foxhole with us and who's opposed to us. And it seems that, you know, Biden and now again, or that Obama now again, Biden are intent on empowering our enemies. And it's just, it's difficult to understand, but when you ask them and they can't explain it, and these are the foreign policy makers in our country, it's scary as heck. I mean, these are the people that are, you know, supposed to be the commander in chief and his staff, and they're just lost in the sauce, Hugh. I mean, they don't even know what's happening. And listen, I'm a believer that the world is a safer place and the world is a stronger place when America leads and America is the world superpower. And that's not just militarily, it's also economically as well. And, you know, I think what Biden is trying to do is continue what Obama was doing, is bring America down a few pegs, bring other countries up, and hey, can't we all be equal? And that is the last thing we want. Like, we do not want to be equal to other countries. You know, we want to be exceptional, and we want to be at that pointy tip of the spear, and just like Reagan said, the shiny city on the hill.
Now, Josh Mandel, I'm coming back to Buckeye Land. 98.9 in the Center for Christian Values in Ohio is going to sponsor a candidate debate, and I'm going to moderate it. You all trust me. You know I'm fair. I am curious. There are at least five serious. Is Senator Dolan in the race or not?
He's going to announce pretty soon.
So he's going to be in?
Yeah, he'll get in. So we had a candidate forum. It was about a week ago in Highland Heights, which is a suburb of Cleveland, and he was there. And he'll get in the race. I mean,
there'll be five serious candidates. What do you think I ought to ask you five about?
Oh, my gosh, there's so many issues. So first of all, let me tell you, I got it marked in my calendar the evening of October 24th. I'm pumped. I've been talking to the folks at Center for Christian Virtue, Aaron Baer and the crew, and the fact that it's going to be the first large debate forum, you know, in that format, and the fact that it's sponsored by Center for Christian Virtue, and the fact that you're coming in to moderate it is just fantastic. So thanks for coming home to do that. I'll tell you some issues that I'm talking about in the campaign trail that I think would be interesting to ask about. One is definitely election integrity. I think as you ask all of us different candidates, you'll find different answers. I've called to abolish the January 6th commission and replace it with a November 3rd commission and use the actual subpoena power and investigative power of the federal government to actually investigate what happened on November 3rd last year. Because as we all know, even though there were 63 cases filed, 61 of them were dismissed on procedural grounds. They weren't argued on the merits. And so the merits actually haven't been investigated in most of these states. And so I think election integrity would be a big issue. Another issue is the Judeo-Christian bedrock of America. You know, my campaign, Hugh, we're not running it through Republican Party groups. We're running my campaign through churches. And I'm going all over the state and I'm going to pastors, and my mantra is pastors over politicians, and we're asking pastors to host me at their churches. We had 300 people at a town hall in Findlay, Ohio, a couple weeks ago, First Nazarene. We were in the middle of a soybean field in Bucyrus. Rural Crawford County had 250 people at Victory and Truth Ministries. We were in a town called Lebanon, which is between Dayton and Cincinnati, at Solid Rock Church. We had 500 people there. And so a lot of what I talk about on the campaign trail is the fact that the secular left has a full-out assault on the Judeo-Christian bedrock of America. And my belief is, rather than watering down on our Judeo-Christian foundation, we should be doubling down. And I think the fact that the Center for Christian Virtue is sponsoring this event, and the fact that it's so prominent what the left and the secular left is trying to do, I think that'd be a great topic.
Well, let me ask you, Josh Mandel. I moderated the Republican recall debate last week in California, and the first question that I asked as moderator was, the critical race theory is everywhere debated, and the left denies that it's an issue. Is it an issue? And if so, what is the left trying to do with it? So I'll just throw that out to you. I don't know if I'm going to ask it in October. Everybody trusts me. I'm fair. What do you think about that? The first question I asked at the California recall debate.
It's absolutely an issue. I talk about all over the state. Last night in this town hall meeting in Cortland, Ohio, in your old backyard, I talked about it. And here's what I said. I said, listen, I have three kids. Gideon, who's 5 years old, Judah, who's 6 years old, and Rosie, who's 8 years old. They don't see race. And critical race theory is all about taking kids who are my kids' age, or the kids and grandkids of your listeners, and teaching them to see race. And it's all about dividing this country. It's part of the Saul Alinsky playbook, goes back generations, to divide the people. And that's what it's all, it's about dividing the people and bringing down the country. And the Chinese and the Russians, they are laughing at us. And like, I'm a big subscriber to Martin Luther King's theory on this. You know, what he said was, he said that he had a dream that one day his kids and his grandkids would be judged not on the color of their skin, but on the content of their character. And I believe we as conservatives should be quoting Martin Luther King and what he just preached all over the country. And I did it last night in Cortland. I'm doing it at these churches around the state of Ohio. And we should put the Democrats and the radical left on their heels and say, why are you perverting what Martin Luther King preached? Why are you taking what Martin Luther King preached and flipping it upside down? And I'll tell you what, Hugh, you know, when I was in the Marine Corps, we didn't care what color skin the guy had next to us. We didn't care what religion they were. We didn't care where they came from, how much money or little money their mommy and daddy had. All we cared was, were they good Marines, you know? And I remember, you know, that's how we were treated at boot camp. And I was at Parris Island from, you know, I arrived there in May of 2000. 4 years later, I found myself in a town called Al-Qaim, which is right where the Euphrates River meets the Iraq-Syria border, Western Anbar province. It's old Babylon. And I guarantee you, Hugh, we didn't care the color of the skin next to me. Whether it was a black guy from the Bronx or a white kid from backwoods Tennessee, I didn't care. They were my brothers, and all I cared was, were they good Marines?
Josh Mandel, I will see you in October. Quick question for you. Over under, Browns 13 wins.
I think you hit it on the head, man. That's actually, I think 13 wins and 3 losses. We're going to the
playoffs. 17-game season, Josh. 13-4, 17-game season, the new NFL. Josh Mandel, I'll see you in October. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.